The universe next door, we've called it, because there is a universe next door to you. Right next to you, people are very different. People are very deep. And how people understand the world is so different often and so deep. It's like there's a whole universe right next door to you, in your classes, right on your seats right now, on the bus. There may as well be a whole universe, the way they look at the world, so different. You see, when Christians share the message of Christianity with others, in some contexts, in a very Christianized sort of context, where people are very Christian in the way they think, then the God they don't believe in is kind of the Christian God, you know? And they kind of agree what the world is like, the problem with the world is human guilt. And so therefore, really, what you need to say if you're talking to someone from a Christianish culture is just, you need to make a decision about what God has done for you in Jesus, repent and believe and trust in him, turn to Jesus. That's the whole role of Christian sharing and evangelism. There was a famous evangelist from the 20th century called Billy Graham, American preacher, who once described his whole ministry as the spiritual gift of calling on people to make a decision, appealing to people to make a decision. I have the gift of the appeal, he said, because when you speak in a Christianish culture, you just need to appeal to people to make a decision. But the further you go from those shared assumptions, the further away into another universe that you go, the less you can just say, God, 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 Jesus, 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 believe, believe, believe. The more you have to, a bit like this reading that we had of this Christian preacher Paul speaking in Athens to such a different worldview that when he spoke about Jesus and the resurrection, they thought he was talking about two gods, Jesus and resurrection. And so he had to do a whole lot more work to paint the whole Christian view of the world. What you mean by God, what you mean by people, what you mean by love, what you mean by the world, what's wrong with the world, what a desirable goal for the world is. I remember once talking to a Christian Indian man who'd become a Christian and started a new churches in India. And he said, when I first became a Christian, there were so many new things. That as a young Christian, I used to pray often to Jesus, dear Jesus, when I get reincarnated, can I please believe in you then too? You see, he still was figuring out what parts of the universe were his Hindu universe and what parts of it were his new Christian universe. It took some time. In fact, some people, as we walk around the university, find the very concept of truth and telling truth, sharing truth, believing truth to be offensive. That's how different views can be. We stole this title from a book, by an old book by someone called a Christian called James Sire. He wrote a book called The Universe Next Door, and in that he said, we need to understand that different religions operate on very different sets of assumptions, and that is the place to start when we begin dialogue and conversation. At least one person in the conversation must realize how different their basic assumptions may turn out to be. And so we're wrestling with that kind of thing. The goal of this series. Look, this is a Christian event, series of events. I'm a Christian. I'm an expert in Christianity. And so I will be speaking from a Christian point of view. I'll be advocating Christianity. I'm not an expert on Buddhism. I'm not an expert on Islam or paganism or these things. I have a popular intellectual's interest and study. I've worked hard to try and understand. I've worked hard to try and read. I will share with you. You, in a sense, you'll get to walk into the universe. This guy, that's me. I'm this guy who's trying to reach out and seeking to listen and understand into the world of Buddhism tonight, or Hinduism or Islam. And you'll get to see how a Christian tries to do that. How a Christian does that. And how we interact and think. Now, maybe you say you are a Buddhist, and you might think I get some things wrong, and I'm sorry about that. But it might be interesting for you to hear, how does a Christian, what do I hear wrongly? What do I misunderstand? Do you know what I mean? And so that will help you see how I think, and maybe you can, through the text message questions or in conversation with me, you can tell me and help me understand better how you think. But what I want to help us do is, Christians, I want you to understand your Christian view of the world better, and think about it by comparing and contrasting with other universes. And others of you who have other different views, I hope as we have this kind of series, you understand Christianity better and understand your own position better. And who knows? Maybe we'll learn, maybe we'll change. My hope for you is that you will actually come to see the beautiful truths and the truest truths that Christianity has to say. And while still holding to precious truths from your religion, you might bring them with you into the great truths of God speaking to us in Jesus. That's my hope for you. All right, so tonight, Buddhism. Now, this is hard work, this stuff. I'll try to be brief, but I also want to be fair. And it's if I'm brief, you get sound bites, it's unfair. Question time goes forever. If I take a little bit more time and a bit more care, maybe I'm more fair, and maybe question time can be a little briefer. We'll do our best. So tonight, then, Buddhism, founded by Siddhartha Gautama, who lived from 563 to 483 BC. So around the time that the Jewish part of the Bible going into Babylon and out of Babylon again and rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. He was a prince who left home at 29 years old, abandoned his wealthy way of life, and then, it is claimed, attained great understanding of reality, enlightenment at 35 years old, and then lived a long life of teaching and preaching his new learnings for 45 years. Siddhartha Gautama is the founder of Buddhism, but not, Christians need to understand this, he's not the foundation. For Christians, Jesus is the foundation. But for Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha only points the way. That is, the enlightened one only points the way. He's not even really quite a prophet, as if there's a message from God's world through him to you. No, he's someone who got there first, a spiritual pioneer who can then share what he's discovered to you. There's a broad canon, again, unlike Christianity, where there's a very defined set of 66 books. There's a broad collection of writings for one school of Buddhism, the kind of oldest school, Theravada Buddhism, the Pali Canon. And then later on many writings of Buddhism built on that in different traditions, Mahayana Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. Buddhists, in statistical terms, are about 7% of the world's population, around 500 million people or so. In China, around 20% of Chinese, Thailand, Japan, Burma, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Cambodia, South Korea, something like that. It's hard to get these statistics really sharp. And that's what we're looking at tonight, the universe next door of Buddhism. We'll look at it under four headings. Firstly, a summary of the central Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths. That's the first heading, the Four Noble Truths. And then after that first heading, we'll then look at three, what I saw as characteristics of Buddhism that we'll then compare and contrast with Christianity. That it is a rational religion or philosophy, it is practical, and it is moral. Rational, practical, moral. Okay, then first, the Four Noble Truths, basic doctrine, common in all branches of Buddhism. Ready for the four? So this is like point one, A, the reality of suffering. Dukkha. A defining experience of life, Buddhism teaches, is suffering. Pain, sickness, death, all suffering, all dukkha. Sadness, grief, betrayal, all suffering, all dukkha. But more, everything is temporary. Everything is fading, transient, crumbling. There's friction, there's insufficiency. All is suffering. All is frustration. Here's a quote from Siddhartha Gautama. Birth is suffering. Decay is suffering. Disease is suffering. Death is suffering. Association with the unpleasing is suffering. Separation from the pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And then within this experience of suffering, then all of life becomes samsara, a term to describe. Samsara is a term that describes the experience of ongoing existence in suffering, running around and around and around again, the grind, the chore, the trap of being stuck in this cycle of suffering. Life is not a Coke ad. Life is not a video clip. All religions, all philosophies have to cope with this problem. This phenomenon of suffering. There's a story of Siddhartha Gautama sending a woman whose child has died to try to find a mustard seed in a house where no one has died. What's the point? Everyone grieves with you. Death is inevitable. Everyone faces the troubles of suffering, the troubles of death. Many of these things sound a lot like those of you who are familiar with the Christian Bible, with a very famous passage from a book called Ecclesiastes. Let me just read to you a little from Ecclesiastes chapter 1. This is from the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament for the Christian Bible. Meaningless, meaningless, Ecclesiastes 1. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. What does man gain from his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come, generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All the streams flow into the sea, but the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again, what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. A wise man sees that. A wise woman sees that, the reality of suffering. Secondly, the cause of this suffering. This is B, 1B, the second noble truth. Suffering springs from craving, Buddhism says, from desire, grasping, clinging. But that means more than just, I want taco, I want donut. It's also the desire just to be, to live, the will to live, the will to be I, to say, I am I, you are you, I am being. Even just that desire. As the founder of the London Buddhist Society, Christmas Humphreys, says, what a name, from raging, ungovernable lust to the purest yearning for the helping of mankind, all can be expressions of craving. And this craving, this desire to be, to live, to be I, leads then to this illusion that I am separate from you and this world with all its suffering and greed and jealousy and wrath and rape and addiction and war and grief and loss. A big emphasis in Buddhism is on cause and effect. Cause and effect. One thing follows another. Good to good. Bad to bad. Like streams flowing, causing and affecting, causing and affecting. And so this experience then of craving goes on and on and on and flows from life to life. There's an idea of what's called karma, cause and effect, rebirth. In Buddhism, it's not that you have a soul and your soul will die in this body and then your soul will go into another body and find a new life in another body. That's more, perhaps, the Hindu teaching. In Buddhism, no, you're just a collection of causes and effects that are jumbled together and you've stupidly called them Jordan. And then we buy into this illusion. But no, you're just a bunch of causes and effects that will crumple down and those causes and effects will go on to live in this realm or another realm. Yeah, it's not a unity of soul, but a bunch of causes and sensations that die and have future effects. There's no real you, no real I. One thing's for sure, however you might think of it in Western philosophy, karma's not particularly good news. If karma leads to rebirth, you're stuck here again. It's, what's the most Russian doll, you know? It's Groundhog Day, it's... Oh, no, not against the myth of Sisyphus. It's here we go again, here we go again. What other ones have we got where you just keep boring back to the centre? Huh? What was that one? Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, yeah. Yeah, that same kind of thing again and again. Reset like every computer game ever, right? It's bad news. I still haven't beat the boss at the end of the level. All this begins with an ignorance that imagines there are distinctions between things. what is called, apologies if my pronunciation is poor, but Sakaya Ditti, the heresy of separateness, that there are separate things. And the goal of Buddha's teaching is to pull apart that illusion of separate things, that I am separate to you, is separate to the chair, is separate to Mount Wellington, that the physical forms and feelings and sensations and perceptions and tendencies and self-consciousness are all this elaborate illusion to be woken up from, to be enlightened from. Noble Truth 1, suffering. Noble Truth 2, the cause of suffering and this grasping and craving and ignorance of distinction. Noble Truth 3, how do we get out of it then? To cease desire, to cease craving, right? The goal of what they call nirvana, to disentangle from the illusion, from this cycle of samsara, of dukkha, of suffering, of frustration, to attain joy, bliss, peace. Not in a personal I get it, because there's no I. Instead, to merge into or discover my place in the void. But it's not nothing, it's a something, it's a suchness, it's a plenum void. An impersonal though, a non-social, non-physical drop in an ocean. Not going to heaven, as some religions have it, or a new creation, as Christianity would have, but to discover the reality of the suchness of the void. And so how do I cease craving, the fourth noble truth? Suffering caused by craving, we need to cease craving. And how do we do that? The Eightfold Path. So 1D then has Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are some understandings you need, right understanding and right aim. There's the way you live needs to change, right speech, right action, right livelihood, how you fill out your days, what you do for a job. And then there's a certain deliberateness, a right effort, a right awareness or mindfulness, and a right concentration or meditation. Understanding, aim, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration. Now, there's much to be admired here. Stuff I was going to say that's actually literally in a footnote in my notes to stop me from saying it. Much to be admired here. You can reflect on some of those things as well. And in all of this, Siddhartha Gautama was aiming to avoid extremes, an extreme of hating the world and trying to deny yourself in a harsh, cruel, extreme way, or the extreme of self-indulgence. He was trying to find a middle way that neither fell into harsh, strict, nor lazy luxury, and that through this path we'd train ourselves to escape the illusion and attain enlightenment in the end. Now, it's questionable whether it really is all that far from being too strict, and so Christians may agree or disagree at that point. But it's important to note in all of this that the goal of right speech, right mindfulness and so on, right life, right livelihood, that these things are not goods in many ways for themselves. They're methods for a goal. They're technique, a kind of, you could say, a spiritual and moral technique for escape. That you do these things to train yourself out of the illusion of yourself, the illusion of all things, to separate yourself from that cycle of craving and suffering. And we'll come back to that. So the Four Noble Truths, we've got them, it's pretty fact of suffering, cause of suffering. The goal is to escape, and the path is this eightfold path. So having done that then, let's step back from that and think together about the ways in which Buddhism is rational, and how does that relate to Christianity? The ways in which it is practical, and how does that interact with Christianity? And the ways in which it's moral. Let's give that a go, shall we? First then, rational. Buddhism, especially the older Theravada Buddhism, some have argued is not really a religion at all. Have you heard that? Hands up if you've heard Buddhism isn't really a religion. Oh, quite a number of you. Yeah, so it's a claim that some make and then others disagree about. It's the kind of thing where you can just go, Buddhism's not a religion, and then just walk away and watch what happens. And some people say, yes, it is, no, it's not, and you can just put your money on who will win. There's no deity, there's no God, although there are many spirits and beings in some versions of Buddhism, arguably all. There's no prophet, but as we'll see, the Buddha isn't far off a prophet. There are a few ceremonies, but there are ceremonies and temples and holy days. Is it a religion or not? There is still a very spiritual universe that Buddhism presents to us. However, it is strongly philosophical, and its philosophical status is close to the surface in a way that you could say other religions philosophy may be a little bit more second and our religion first, perhaps we can say that. And for this very reason, many Western spiritual people find Buddhism very appealing, that because of this philosophical nature to it, and actually because some of its ideas resonate with modern scientific and psychological thoughts. It seems to jive well with Western thinking in particular ways. It claims to be empirical, that is, do you know empirical? In testing the world, scientific, broadly speaking, testing and examining experience. The claim is that Gautama discovered something. He discovered and found out the way things are. He experienced and found out. And you can follow his path and you can repeat his experiment. Do not go by hearsay, said the Buddha in his famous advice to the Kalamas, nor by what is handed down by others, nor by what is stated on the authority of your traditional teachings. He's often reacting against Hindu priests and teachers here, say the Brahmin. And don't just listen to what they say. Don't go by reason, nor by inference, nor by arguments as to method, nor by reflection on and approval of an opinion, nor out of respect, thinking a recluse, a hermit, must be deferred to. When these teachings, followed out and put into practice, conduce to loss and suffering, reject them. Just to kind of test it and see. In fact, it's claimed by some that it's the most rational of religions. Someone I'll quote quite a bit through this is that fabulously named Christmas Humphreys from the London Buddhist Society. And he just writes very beautifully in some of the things he has to say. And here's one section where he advocates strongly for Buddhism. As it stands today, although edited, negative, and escapist, as some say, the teachings of the Theravada school of Buddhism is still the finest moral philosophy available. It is reasonable, making no appeal to dogmatic assumption. It is objective and will stand the criticism of logic and science. It is self-reliant, claiming assistance from neither God nor gods, saviours or priestly men. It is the most tolerant creed on earth and expresses compassion not only for all men but for all animals and the least living thing. Some describe it as pessimistic, which is ignorant. If this were true, and it's quite untrue, he says, it's strange that its adherents today, the Sinhalese, Burmese, Siamese and Cambodians, that dates a bit when this book was written, are among the merriest, happiest people on earth. In terms of Western philosophy, it is derivable from inductive reasoning by logical inference from observed first premise. And on he goes. It's interesting to compare even how some of the Gautama's teachings about no self, there's no Jordan, just a bundle of sensations, that's quite similar to the Western philosopher David Hume, modern skeptic philosopher of the last few hundred years, for example. Or the sense of perception and illusion, the writings of Berkeley, similarly kind of jive with that. Observations about suffering, observations about cause and effect, much overlaps with modern thinking, psychology, and we'll see more of that in our next point. It doesn't require reverent submission to some higher authority in the way the Bible does. Christians say this is God speaking to us. Or a Muslim will say the Quran is the crowning jewel of God's speech to us. And so, one aspect of this means that anybody, atheist, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, can actually approach the philosophical offerings, the psychological findings of Buddhism as just that, as offerings. And you can go, oh yeah, good point. And you can actually learn, and on one level, that is honouring Buddhism on one level, to say, look, here's what I discovered, and you go, yeah, that's a good point. And you can actually learn from that. And that's a really useful thing to do. And Christianity can do that because it also, in addition to 10 commandments or prophecies of Isaiah, we have the philosophical discussions about suffering in the book of Job, or the practical observations of everyday life in the Proverbs, many little practical sayings and hints and tips. Or that bizarre, pessimistic, philosophical book, Ecclesiastes. Yeah? And so we can say, oh yeah, our tradition does that too. You know, reflects on the nature of the universe, of the winds and the streams and the ant, and tries to learn from these things. Christianity, like Buddhism, honours the human mind. Christianity, like Buddhism, honours reason, thought, experience. Even though the Christian wants to say we are spoiled by sin, biased because of sin, and our finite human nature, and are limited, sin and guilt and limitation does not nullify human thought. We still believe in thinking and learning and knowing, and so are open to others who are interested in that. We, like Buddhists, are interested in teaching. I'm going on, aren't I? Christians are into going on and on through teaching. Buddhists are into going on and on and on in teaching because it's good to learn. It's good to think. A religious student is a religious student, not just a minion. So Buddhism is about teaching and understanding and grasping. Even listen to this. Those of you who are Christians here, familiar with John's Gospel, there's some interesting echoes here. Here's the last teaching of the Buddha. My disciples, the teaching I've given you are never forgotten or abandoned. They are always to be treasured. They are to be thought about. They are to be practiced. If you follow these teachings, you will always be happy. If you neglect them, it means that you've never really met me. It means that you're far from me, even if you are actually with me. But if you accept and practice my teachings, then you are very near me, even though you are far away. My disciples, my end is approaching. Our parting is near, but do not lament. Life is ever-changing. None can escape the dissolution of the body. This I am now to show by my own death, my body falling apart like a dilapidated cart. A human body must die, but the wisdom of enlightenment will exist forever in the truth of the teaching and the practice of the teaching. He who sees merely my body does not truly see me. Only he who accepts my teaching truly sees me. After my teaching, the teaching shall be your teaching. Follow the teaching and you will be true to me. After the 45 years of my life, I have withheld nothing from you in my teachings. There's no secret teaching, no hidden meaning. Everything has been taught openly. That's quite similar to Jesus' teaching in John's Gospel. Teaching is a wonderful thing. You meet your teacher in their teaching. You know your teacher in their teaching. You show your love for your teacher in obeying and understanding their teaching. Now, the teaching of Jesus and the Buddha are very different. Jesus taught about a one God, personal God, Father, Son, and Spirit, who created the world and will rescue the world from judgment through Jesus' saving death on the cross, and that the hope for the world is a new creation freed from suffering and evil. But there are also points of similarity in the teaching. Both Buddhism and Christianity are teaching religions. Their followers are students, much more, but students. They have books, they make books, they write books, they give books away. And they're missionaries. Every religion has to have a way to grow, through military conquest, through being absorbed into folk religion and mutating, or through preaching. And Buddhism, like Christianity, spread through preaching, teaching, persuading, traveling monks, founding monasteries to bring their teachings to everybody else. In fact, Gautama gave a great commission, just like Jesus gives in Matthew 28. He said to his disciples, "Go forth, O bhikkhus, on your journey for the profit of many, for the bliss of many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, profit, bliss of mankind. Go not any two together. Proclaim, O bhikkhus, the teaching, goodly in its beginning, goodly in its middle, goodly in its ending, in the spirit and in the letter. Make known the perfect, pure, righteous life." He told a parable about a house caught on fire. The man was away from home, and when he came back, he found his children so absorbed in play. They hadn't noticed the fire inside the house, and the father screams, "Get out, children, get out, come out of the house, hurry, hurry." But the children didn't heed him. The anxious father shouted again, "Children, I have some wonderful toys here, come out of the house, get them." Heeding his cry, the children ran out of the burning house. The world is a burning house. The people, unaware the house is on fire, are in danger of being burned to death. So Buddha, in compassion, devises a way of saving them. Now, I've heard a lot of Christian preachers say pretty much that exact same thing. The world is in need of good teaching about truth and life and salvation. And someone who's full of compassion, who sees things truly, part of their love is actually to go and teach and tell. You can preach in a way that's rude and mean and intolerant and unwelcome. But that doesn't mean all teaching and preaching and evangelism is rude, intolerant and unwelcome. I hope the way we try to do things in our ping pong balls and our Christianity 1As and our citywides is to teach what we think is important, what we think is really important, the most important thing. And that we try to do it as no doubt the Buddhist monks and Buddhist teachers try to do it, in a way that is compassionate, respectful, and persuasive. You can tell us how well we go at that. But we must keep saying, must insist, I think, that there is a place for persuasion, for religious persuasion, for tolerant, respectful, loving, courteous, clear, strong, unafraid, uncompromising discussion and persuasion. But a last point on this, the longest point, is that there's a strange sense in which the rationality of Buddhism reasons itself into a kind of irrationality. The rationality of Buddhism reasons itself into irrationality. As Humphreys says, streams like Zen Buddhism use reason to break reason. Sounds pretty similar to some streams of Western philosophy too. It's possible, you could say, Buddhism becomes so beyond this world and so beyond our present everyday experience that everyday reason no longer works. And so oddly, ironically, Buddhism can end up with irrationalism. Zen Buddhism pretty deliberately aims for that, to provide enlightenment by confronting you with mysteries, with riddles, with nonsense, to kind of break you out. Besides, many of the teachings that come into Buddhism, ideas like rebirth, assertions like the universal nature of loving kindness and the complex realms and spirit realms and so on, they're going a long way beyond scientific, empirical philosophy. Now, Buddhists would say, oh, no, it's still empirical, you just haven't seen it yet. When you see it, then you'll see it's just as scientific as anything else. But, I mean, that's what Muhammad would say as well. If you sort of encountered the revelation of Allah as well, it would have been scientific for you too. And Jesus' disciples would have said it. When you were there and Jesus walked on the water, that was empirical. At what point do Gautama's claims really become prophetic claims of a kind? I have encountered a reality so beyond this reality, and none of you will get there in a hurry, so kind of take my word for it. Do you see what I mean? Christianity doesn't slip, should not slip into the same irrationality, this drifting away from everyday reason, because we say, we believe in a God who made this world understandable, He made people to understand the world. He's spoken understandably to explain the world. He writes history with a direction and a meaning. He tells a story about what the world is going to, so we can understand the world we live in, rather than being lifted into mysteries beyond the world. Here we go. Rational. To the point, maybe, of becoming irrational. Secondly, in terms of these reflections to Buddhism, four noble truths, rational, now practical. And if after practical we've had enough, we can pause there and you can ask me what I was going to say about the moral thing in question time. Perhaps we do that. So practical. There's a practical stream in Buddhism where, for example, Gautama avoided certain abstract questions, questions with no use to know the answer. What's nirvana like? Is there any kind of ultimate self? How does karma work in detail? You don't need to know. The main emphasis is on here and now. What will help you now? What will progress you now? And so it brings with it a certain... a whole lot of observations about psychology and experience. Intense analysis of our experience and our psychology, breaking down thoughts and sensations and desires and perceptions in a way that's really insightful. For a 6th and 5th century BC philosophy, it says a whole lot of stuff that psychologists and counsellors and psychiatrists are still discovering. Going, yeah, that rings pretty true for what it's like to be and to think. And so it's practically helpful to learn from these analyses and where they're accurate, go, oh, yeah. For a Buddhist, these studies of psychology are a part of a spiritual process to escape the cycle of suffering. It's a spiritual path. How does a Christian interact with Buddhist psychology? Well, for a Christian, this world is real and it's good, including your body and your mind and your senses. And so understanding your body and your mind and your senses are just understanding part of the real world. It's not understanding an illusion that you must spiritually escape from. You see that difference? It's a little bit like in Hindu practice, the physical yoga exercises, which is part of Hindu practice. These physical exercises, because the body and the spirit are all one in Hinduism, as I understand it, these physical exercises of yoga are one of the paths to help me, again, merge with the one. The physical and the spiritual are one in essence. For a Christian, the body is just a body, like God made a body. It's good. In that sense, it's spiritual. God made it. But it's a machine in a way. God has given me this machine to walk with. And if my walking's a little stiff, I could do some exercises that Hindus invented as a yoga path to enlightenment. I could just go, hey, that kind of works my core muscles. Thanks. But it's not a path to oneness for a Christian. It's a path to core strength, which is good because God made my body and it's good. Do you see what I mean? Do you see how a Christian believes the world is real and the world is a thing, God is a thing, the world is a thing, God made the world, then I can learn from the physical exercises of some streams of Hinduism and kind of borrow them for their physical benefit. In the same way, the psychological observations of Buddhism, it might sit within a system of escaping from suffering. But for me, my brain's real, my body's real, the world's real, and it could still be helpful to learn how to understand the world better, how to understand my head better, how to understand the way I perceive the world better. Not to help me escape from it, it's real. It might help me then live better in the world. But do you see what I mean? A Christian will approach these observations in a different framework, still benefit greatly, but differently. Does that make sense? I don't worship with a yogic practice, but I might strengthen my body through similar motions. I don't enlighten myself through mindfulness or meditation, but I might calm myself and my body. So, for example, let's use mindfulness. Mindfulness practices, many which have drawn from Buddhist practices, have been enormously helpful for religious, of many different religious types, and entirely atheistic people. They found the practices very helpful in dealing with anxiety, dealing with depression, sports performance. The ability to step back, to realize there's a observing me and a thinking feeling me, and I can actually learn to step back a little from the thinking feeling me and just go, oh yeah, I'm thinking that and I'm feeling that. Oh, there it goes. You know, and that can be quite a helpful thing. If you're stuck in a storm of thinking and feeling, then to step back a little from it can kind of be a relief. Just carry on, fellas, come on, carry on. And just watch it for a while. That can be a really good discipline to learn in controlling anxiety or controlling depression or focusing oneself. Helping you learn just to switch off and vague out. Or to zero in on something. Focus better. In fact, some Christians have even, you can get this app, you can search this up, an app called Planted from our Newtown Erskineville Church in Sydney. Planted is, I think it's a Christian psychologist, has taken some of the techniques of mindfulness apps and just turned it to reflecting on Psalms. Blessed is the man who walks in the ways of the righteous like a tree planted by the stream. Picture the tree planted by the stream. Picture its leaves, picture its branch. You know, listen to this. You know, all that mellow, soothing Jedi sort of voice, you know. And so you could, if you chose, go, well, look, I'm going to do this mindful thing anyway instead of being on a boat and feeling the water on the boat or whatever. There's a ping pong ball on your tummy. Feel it rise with your tummy and sink with your tummy. Instead, well, if I'm doing that anyway, I may as well do it with Psalm 1. You could check out the plan today. You don't have to do it with Psalm, you don't have to do it with the Bible, but you could. And you could find that reflection, concentration, dwelling becomes another helpful way to reflect on God's word. A final observation on this practical heading, and then should we finish there, Jordan, or should we go to the last thing? How are people doing? Are we full? Are you full? Yeah, cool. All right, so I'll finish the practical heading. If you're interested in what I might say in the moral heading, then you can ask and I can share a couple of comments during the question time. So a final observation on where this practical dimension of Buddhism heads is self-reliance. From the Buddha's last teaching, make yourself a light, rely upon yourself, do not depend on anyone else. Be the master of your own mind. Be an island to yourself. Work out your salvation with diligence. Or again, another quote, by oneself evil is done, by oneself one suffers, by oneself evil is left undone, by oneself evil is purified. It's something that Buddhism can celebrate and boast in a kind of a way. Here's Humphreys. An understanding of the law of karma leads to self-reliance. In proportion that we understand karma's operation, we cease to complain about our circumstances, cease from turning with the weakness of a child to a man-made god to save us from the consequence of our acts. Karma is no god, for the gods itself, themselves, are under the sway of karma. Only the ignorant person personifies karma, tries to bribe karma, petition karma, cajole karma. Wise men understand it and confront it. There could be something really dignifying in this. Rely on yourself. Step up, shoulders back. Don't need a crutch. But this truth of self-reliance is only good if it's true. If you've got a crutch and you don't need a crutch, then it's very sensible to throw it away and walk free. If you have an injury that can be healed, fix the injury and get rid of the crutch. However, if you're seriously injured, you're broken, fractured, damaged, and you throw away your crutch and insist on walking without it in proud self-reliance, you could make things worse. Yeah? You make yourself a fool in falling and stumbling and hurting yourself more. If, as Jesus Christ taught, we are sinful, guilty, And this guilt stands before a real God that we cannot wipe the guilt away. We cannot overcome our evil nature by the eightfold path. It may be restrained but never conquered. If the only real path to freedom is to be forgiven by God in his Son Jesus and then led by his Spirit in his ways, and that the hope is to be made new by God's power in the resurrection life, if that's true, if there's a God and we're guilty before him and he forgives us in Jesus and gives us a hope to come, if that's true, then to trust only in myself following the eightfold path is a blind alley, a recipe for frustration or even delusion. Good things become lies when they are made the whole thing. Besides, is it livable? Many appeal to Buddhism loosely as a vague mood. Some serious ones strive to be faithful to this self-reliance, but it's interesting how in practice the grand school of Mahayana Buddhism has become very religion-like, with its priests and its temples and its ceremonies and its kind of gods. As Humphreys himself admits, much of the teaching found today in Mahayana schools is, on the face of it, the exact antithesis of the message recorded in the early Pali canon. In the end, we maybe realise, I can't rely only on myself. I need some help from without. Where is that help found? And ultimately, we want to be saying the help is found in Jesus. For in Jesus we find not just a word of a kind of love as a method to escape suffering, not just Jesus as a kind of love in the void, which is so impersonal, it's really not any love I know and understand in this experience at all. But in Jesus I find the love of a personal God who made me, who loves me, who knows me, who cares about me, who knows my actions, takes my actions serious, very seriously, but forgives my actions in his gracious gift of Jesus' death for my sins, and whose purpose for me is to forgive me, save me, rescue me, love me, and bring me to a new life where I, together with you, love one another for all eternity and love our God for all eternity. Different, but united in loving relationship and worship. And that's why the Christian loves, because they have been loved, and the hope for the future is eternal, personal, spiritual love. How about we pray?